I think Liza Minnelli said it best, or sang it best, money makes the world go round. From ancient clay tablets in Mesopotamia to today's digital and even crypto systems, money has shaped nearly every aspect of human civilization. It's not just bills and coins, but a technology built on trust that connects buyers and sellers, employers and employees, and citizens and states around the world. Author and economist David McWilliams digs deep into money and how it makes the world go round in his new book, The History of Money, A Story of Humanity. We're very fortunate to be joined by him this morning. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning, Kevin. It's an absolute pleasure to be talking to you. Absolute pleasure.
Let's start off. What motivated you to write the book and how long did it take to do all that research?
Well, I tell you what, Kevin, I have been a monetary economist for 30 odd years. I started my career many, many years ago in the Irish Central Bank, where we had our own currency, our own interest rates, our own exchange rate. So it was in effect sort of the tabernacle where money is sort of magicked up by the high priests of central banking. So we a bit like working at the Fed here in the United States. Then I went to investment banking, where money in a form of a promise, which is what I call credit, which that's what it is. It's a promise to pay back money to somebody else at some stage in the future. That money in a form of a promise is funneled by investment banks all around the world. So you can see from the real inside what was happening, then from the banking system what was happening. And then over the last 15 odd years, 20 odd years, I have been a professor at university talking about it, teaching monetary economics. I have made documentaries, written books, et cetera, et cetera. And the one thing, I had a niggling feeling, which was very, very strange, which was that my tribe, the economists, who took it upon ourselves to explain money to the average Joe on the street, I had this feeling that we didn't really understand money. We didn't really get the full power of money. We didn't understand, or at least we were afraid to evoke this idea that money is a force in our society. It is a technology. It is the force that binds humanity together for good and ill. And I thought, hold on, there's a bigger, bigger question here. And the question that economics normally limits itself to, Kevin, is I think that economists, or many economists, are a wee bit like plumbers, right? So they're, if you have a plumber in the house and you ask the plumber, look, how does the water get around the pipe? And how does the combination of gravity and pressure work? And, you know, I want to get water down to the basement. How do I do that? The plumber will be able to tell you how the water gets around the pipes of the system. But if you sat the plumber down for a beer after the day's work and you said, man, water, why is it important for life? Why is it essential for life? I don't think many plumbers could answer that question. And I think it's the same thing in a little bit with economists, that the economists can tell you how money gets funneled around the piping system, from the banks to your deposit account, from your credit card, your mortgage, all that sort of stuff, you know, the money supply, etc. But if you'd ask the economists, what does it do to us? What actually does money do to us? What is it? Why is it so transgressive? Why do we want it? Why is it sexy? Why is it dangerous? Why is it power? Why is it lust? Why is it greed? Why is it all these human characteristics? Then I think the economists would shrink. So the idea in this book is to try and put money into the context of humanity. And by that, I mean, it seems to me that money is the foundational technology of human civilization. Without understanding our relationship with money, you can't understand us at all. You can't understand human progress. You can't understand human civilization. You can't understand the history that has got us to this place. So that was my first sort of insight, that there's something much more deep going on. So what is it? Where did it come from? And in order to answer those questions, I had to go back to the very, very beginning. Now, with respect to the question on research, I suppose, in fairness, I've been thinking about writing this book. I've written 6 other books, but largely for the local Irish audience. And this is the first one that's very international. And I suppose I've been thinking, Kevin, you know, in my little walks, sitting, having a pint, pottering around the world, looking after the kids, taking them to school, all that sort of stuff. I've probably been thinking about this book for a long, long time. So the research is a culmination of maybe 2 decades of thought on the whole thing.
And maybe a few conversations at the pub over a few pints.
Many, many conversations at the pub. My mates see me and they run away and say, oh no, here's your man. I'm going to talk about economics again. You know,
exactly.
Limit your conversation to Irish blokes, to football and politics, you'll be fine.
So now, how did writing this book, rather than a pure economics book, as you had mentioned in the past, change your way you thought about people's emotions, you know, fear, greed, hope,
So the central thesis of the book, so just for your listeners, Gavin, is that money is man's most essential social technology. Now, social technology is quite different to a physical technology. So when we think of technology, we think physical, we think like the internet or the wheel or the car or whatever, right? But there's also these things in economics called social technology. And social technologies are technologies that allow us humans to collaborate and cooperate better at scale. So a good example of that would be the legal system, which is basically the rules of the game, right? And if you look at money in that context, then it begins to open up a whole new vista, which brings us into your emotional question. So what I did in the book was I went back to see where did we first see money emerging? And then what struck me was the co-evolution of money and other building blocks of human civilization. So we go back about 5,000 years to the Sumerian civilization. What you see there is the co-evolution of money emerges at the same time as legal systems, around the same time as writing, which is an amazing technology, around the same time as counting, numericism, little bits of mathematics. And then what you also see is organized religions come at the same time. You begin to say, okay, well, hold on. Are all these things related? Were all these things conceived in and around a period when our race, our species, humanity, had to deal with other complex issues? Because the one thing we know about humans is what makes us successful is that we are amazingly good at solving problems and deploying technology to do that. That's, in a sense, the history of human evolution, or human, at least, social evolution. Then you think, okay, they all came around the same time. What problems were they solving? And they were solving problems of complexity, whereby the gradual move from being a nomadic people to being a domesticated people threw up problems of complexity for us, because for the first time in our history as a species, we were living together, because nomadic people were not living together. They were actually, in a sense, avoiding each other for much of the period. And they were living in small tribal communities where everybody knew everybody else. Once you start living in complex societies, when you have to deal with complexity, who am I? Where's my role? How do I trade? How do I get things? Where am I in the hierarchy? Where do I sit? How do I value things? Who's this guy coming up here? Do I know him? Should I trust him? Should I not trust him? Do I like him? All these sort of decisions are foisted upon us very rapidly. And as a result of that, I believe we came up with the technology money to make an increasingly complicated world less complicated, because money amplifies trust. And trust is the cornerstone of any complicated society. I have to trust you. You have to trust me. But the thing about Kevin and David don't know each other. So how do they trade with each other? How do they see? How do they give a feel for each other? Well, we don't have to do that because we have money. So money takes away the need for me to know you. As long as you trust the money and I trust the money, you and I can do business together. We can live side by side together. We don't need to know everything about each other. Why? Because in the price is all this information about you. It's like a shortcut. So when you see that, when you look at money as a social technology, then you begin to see this crazy mad technology everywhere and evolutions in this crazy mad technology everywhere. So that's where we go back 5,000 years. Then we go to the Lydians, to the Greeks, to the Romans, and away we go.
Okay, so listeners who haven't read the book yet, how do you define money in its most fundamental sense? And why do you call it, well, we just went over why you call it a social technology. Actually,
I can answer that question.
Okay, great.
I think that the way I've been looking at money is, you know, the ancient Greeks, right? They used to think that the world was determined by four natural elements, you know, the four elements. And they were earth, wind, fire, and water. I think the best way to look at money is that it is the fifth element. It is a force that humans created in our own heads that is as Promethean a force as any of the natural elements, because it propels us forward. It animates all of our ambitions. It puts a price on desire. It puts a price on scarcity. It puts a price on also on innovation. And once you see it as this Promethean force, for the first 200,000 years of our existence, anthropologists and ancient historians, they call us a pyrophyte species. which was a species that was determined by our relationship with one technology. And that technology was fire. And it was humans' ability to make fire, to keep fire, to deploy fire, really set us aside from other animals. I think in the last 5,000 years, we have become a plutified species. Oh, I made this word up myself, Kevin, so you won't hear it anywhere else, right? But that is a species that has been completely adapted to and is constantly adapting with and thinking about another technology, and that technology is money. So you cannot understand this crazy world of 7 billion of us living in relative peace, it must be said. I mean, there's outbreaks of war, but in relative peace, 7 billion humans living on the planet. It is inconceivable to understand that without examining the role of and our relationship to and with this extraordinary technology. And what makes it even more interesting, Kevin, is it's entirely invented. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. It's invented. It's only invented because you and I believe it invented.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the original clay tablets in Mesopotamia were almost credit in a way.
They were credit. Yes, exactly what they were. They're only annotations of credit. And in fact, it's very humbling for a writer. You would imagine that the history of writing, the genesis of writing, comes from something amazing, some great, great epic, or some great poem. No, it comes from accountancy. It all started with accountants, right? Blessed are the accountants, is what I say, right? The much maligned bean counters, they were the people who started writing in the first place. So what intrigues me is to see money in its role as this extraordinary, entirely human force, because money doesn't exist, unlike the other elements, in the natural world. Like, dogs don't worry about money. They don't get up in the morning and say, how's my checking account doing, right? It's an entirely human invention, which only exists because we, 7 billion of us, have collectively subscribed to suspend our critical faculties. And if I walk into a bar in Utah, which I would love to do, okay? And you might even teach me how to ski properly because I'm an Irishman. Okay?
There you go.
And I give over 20 bucks and somebody gives me a beer. We both accept the trade works and we're all happy. And that means we connect. It's a connective tissue in society. And the beautiful thing is, if you really think about it, it doesn't exist. So we don't really think about it. Maybe the measure of money's success is the fact that we don't think about it. We just assume it. We just do it. It's second nature.
Now, since we're on Mesopotamia and since we're on beer, let's take a look at Kushim, the Sumerian beer maker, who was the first person in the world to ever go in debt, to take out a loan.
He was also the first person in the world whose name we know. That's even more interesting. And why do we know it? Because he got into debt. So Kushim, so just so your listeners know, cuneiform is the alphabet of the Sumerian civilization, regarded as the most ancient form of writing. And it has been the subject of all sorts of anthropological inquests. And I mean, believe me, I went down those tributaries, you know, because when you're writing a book like this, you've got to go off to areas you've never been before. But Kushim was the first name we ever imagined. And again, as I say, with respect to literature, we'd imagined the first name that was ever written down was some great god or some great king or some warrior or some lover. No, he was a dude who was actually a home brew producer, right? So he was brewing beer and he borrowed money, like all entrepreneurs do, to tide him over, okay? And he's obligated to pay that money back in a year's time. And the rate of interest was 33%. So it's penal, number one. And number two, if you don't pay back in those days, you and your family went into debt slavery. So the stakes were extremely high. So what I found fascinating about money is that suddenly I could understand a Kushim. I could understand a guy who's got a small business, who's in debt, who needs prices to remain for his beer quite high, whereas prices for his input, his barley, quite low, so that he can pay back the debt and still make a small profit. And in that way, money makes the ancient world modern, because Kushim's concerns are concerns that all of us can deal with, right? And in a way, what it does is it, whereas in contrast, when I read things about, you know, ancient Mesopotamia and their gods and their this, that, and the other, it seems very remote. But actually, when you think about the fact that the society was agonizing about the same stuff we're agonizing about, do I have enough cash? What's the grocery bill going to be? Is the cost of living too high? What's the rate of interest? How am I going to pay back? Then suddenly ancient people become very modern. because they're just like us. Yeah. They're just like us. Their emotional range is exactly the same as us. It's their technological range wasn't the same as us, but their emotional range to be human was as similar back then as it is now. And money, in a way, for me, makes that all clickable, explicable, understandable, and relevant. It's just a way of looking at the world, you know, that they're not a million miles from us.
Yeah. Now, can you tell us a little bit about Diocletian?
Oh, yeah.
Was he the first leader to devalue his money?
He wasn't the first. In fact, as we see now with President Donald Trump having to go at the Fed, this has been, you know, because he wants the Fed to print more money. This is exactly what Diocletian wanted. It's exactly what Nero wanted. This is as old as the hills. It's exactly what Henry VIII wanted. But basically, you've got a guy at the top says, let's get the party going, right? For me and for others. How do I do it? Let's get the guys who print the money to print a bit more. And if the guys who print the money say, well, I don't want to do that because we're worried about inflation, well, what we can do is we can go behind their back and put a little bit of copper into the gold coin. And Bob's your uncle, we've got more money circulating. So Diocletian was actually called in. Ironically, Diocletian was called in. He was the last great Roman Balkan emperor. Many would argue that the beginning at the end of the Roman Empire starts with Diocletian. So we're talking about 300 AD. But he comes after a guy or a series of second-rate emperors were devaluing the currency. So he comes in, he's trying to stabilize things. Many, many, in fact, over 300 reasons have been given by historians for the end of the Roman Empire. But fascinatingly, one of those reasons was not or has not been the debasement of the currency, the gradual erosion of trust that Romans had in their currency in the denarius, and the gradual gutting of the gold content of the currency, so much so that by the end of the Roman Empire, Roman merchants were invoicing each other in real goods. And that's what happens in inflation, right? We're the same for the Roman Empire now as they are for the United States or Britain or whatever, or Europe, right? And that, again, is a fascinating thread in the book, is that what happens today happened before. Everything that has happened in the economy has happened before. And it's just a matter of finding those examples and basically enlivening those for the reader.
Now, as long as we're staying with some of the fun characters in the book, can you go over John Law, the Scotsman?
A great character. John Law, for your listeners, is the father of monetary economics. In fact, he saved me in a way, because I always thought to myself, isn't it awful that my profession are so, have got such bad raps, they're not good crack, they're not good fun, etc. And then you come across John Law, who was a bounder, a scoundrel, a gambler, a womanizer, a lover, the whole nine yards. And what Law did was he created the first real fiat money, the sort of money we use now, money issued by the state. It was a disastrous experiment called the Mississippi Bubble in Louisiana. People forget that Louisiana at the time was not the state of Louisiana now. Louisiana, or French North America, went from Canada all the way down to Louisiana and all the way west to California, or to the boundaries of the Mexican Empire, right? So it was a huge place. And Law came up with a whiz. He was trying to figure out how he could print more money in France to get the French out of debt. And he thought, okay, you know what would be a great idea? Would be to create a currency backed by the shares of a company and get people to get all excited about that company and then swap the shares of that company into paper and call that paper currency, and then we can use that. So it would be a bit like the Fed deciding to back the dollar with NVIDIA shares today, okay? Right? And then as the NVIDIA share price rises and rises, we could print more money. So he said, I don't have an NVIDIA. I'm going to have to invent this company. So in the same way as AI is capturing people's imagination today, what captured people's imagination back then were the colonies, were the European colonies in North America and Latin America, because that's where money was being made hand over fist. So he created a company, and buying a share in that company gave you the right or the ability to play a part in or share in the undoubted upside that was investing in the colonies for timber, for agriculture, for gold, for silver, everything that was found, for coffee, for cotton, all these things that were found in the colonies, right? But it was a great swiz. It was just a complete fraud. But in the same way as people today get excited by new technology, by the prospect of the world changing, as I always say, equity is only a fancy word for hope, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically you and I hope that something's going to go up in value and away we go. So Law constructed this whole new currency in France. The whole thing's collapsed. He managed to get away with his life, not once, but twice. As I say in the book, he was a total scoundrel. He was also a murderer, which is a very unusual place to start. And his story is phenomenal because it links America, it links Latin America, the Caribbean, France, Britain, the pre-Napoleonic Wars. It brings us up to the French Revolution. I think that one of the reasons the French Revolution happened was because Law, because the French were so stung and were so, it was like their 2008 event. They were so traumatized by it that they refused to innovate in money for the entire 18th century. And this facilitated a very fragile, or in a way, gutted the strength and muscularity of the French state. And before you know it, you have a revolution. The amazing thing about John Law is the guy died happily in his own bed, a wealthy man in exile in Venice.
Oh,
so he managed to slip the noose.
Okay, let's see.
He's a great character.
So if you could drop one story or episode from the book into every school curriculum to help young people understand money better, which one would it be?
Well, I think I would like to drop the opening story, the story of Adolf Hitler trying to destabilize the United Kingdom with the single biggest fraud, counterfeit operation that has ever been attempted. So Adolf Hitler, 1942, thinks, okay, these British, we can't bomb them. We can't, the Luftwaffe can't win. They've managed to beat us, their island nation. If they remain in the war, the Americans will have a bridgehead. The Americans will eventually use Britain as the landing area, the preparation for an invasion of Europe. We've got to stop these people. But how do we do it? We can't stop them with guns. They seem to be, and planes. But Hitler had lived through the hyperinflation in Germany in the 1920s. And in fact, many people argue that the reason Hitler came to power was because the hyperinflation. The hyperinflation had destroyed the German middle class in the 20s. It destroyed the trust between the state and the citizen, between the taxed and the taxpayer, between producers and suppliers, as we said at the top. So it destroyed the trust. But Hitler thought, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to orchestrate the biggest forgery ever. And I am going to drop these forged £5 notes over the United Kingdom. And I'm going to assume that although some people will go to the authorities and say there's money falling out of the sky, lots of us will put a few quid in our back pocket, a few dollars, a few pounds in our back pocket, say, shh, say nothing, right? So amazingly, a counterfeiting squad was taken. So they went around all the concentration camps in Europe where Jewish people were being murdered, were being locked up, were being, eventually we know we're going to be gassed. And they found everybody you need to counterfeit, to make fake money. Printers, paper experts, artists, bankers, mathematicians who can get the serial number right, former central bankers, all this stuff. And they went around and they found 127 Jewish men who were in a terrible state, starving, emaciated, terrified. They were brought to Sachsenhausen concentration camp, which is just outside Berlin. You can still go there now. And each one had a job to do, but collectively their job was to break the Bank of England, to produce a perfect forgery, and then to print as many of those forgeries. And in the end, they printed 180 million pounds sterling worth of forgeries, which is equivalent to about $10 billion today. And the plan was to drop those over the United Kingdom. The problem for the Germans was that once they got the forgery right, and they actually did an amazing thing, once they had their forge, they said, okay, let's do the following. We'll send a German industrialist, quote unquote, to Switzerland with a suitcase of these forged notes. And that industrialist will say to the Swiss banker in Zurich, look, I'm really worried. I've just done a deal. I've just been paid in sterling. And I'm worried these are forgeries. Can you double check them for me? So ironically, the bank, the Swiss bank I worked for, UBS, was the bank they went to, which is kind of interesting, right? So the industrialist goes, it gives it to the Swiss bankers. Swiss bankers say, okay, we'll check it's a forgery. They get together with their big lights and their serial numbers and blah, blah, blah. Looking for all sorts of indicators of forgery. The Swiss bankers come back and say, no, these are perfect. These are real Bank of England notes. And the guy doubles down and says, look, I know you said they are, but can you do me a favor? Can you send them to the Bank of England in London to make sure that they are happy that they originally printed these banknotes? They send them to the Bank of England, and amazingly, they come back to Switzerland. A week later, the Bank of England says, yes, we printed these, right? So not only did the forgers pull the wool over the eyes of the Swiss, they pulled the wool over the eyes of the Bank of England, the very people they should have printed the money in the first place. Then they knew they were away. They were elated completely. They went back to Germany, said, yeah, we can do this. The only problem was it was going to be an airdrop of notes over England. That meant they needed many, many Luftwaffe planes. And they didn't have the airplanes because the planes were ground down and bogged down in the fight in Russia. So they thought, what are we going to do with this stuff? The Nazis were thinking, look, we've got all this forged money. The Bank of England thinks it's money. We know it's not, but nobody else knows it's not. They start to spend it. So all the art forgeries, all the great arts that were actually the Nazis, they didn't just rob the art, they paid for it. All the visas that they paid for to get the Nazis out of Argentina, from Europe to Argentina, were all paid for this. And the coup de grace at the end of it is amazing. Mussolini was kidnapped by Italian communists at the end of 1943. And what was the ransom for Mussolini paid in by the Germans? The forged English banknotes that had been forged by the Jewish prisoners in Sachsenhausen concentration camp. Now, you couldn't make this stuff up. And I would tell kids this because kids, I've always said it in economics, right? Stories are the way humans communicate. Like when my kids are now older, but when they were younger and when they were, you know, when a little boy or little girl is up at night and they have a bad tooth or whatever, how you soothe a child to sleep is you tell them stories. And that makes connections in our heads and it pacifies us. I've never seen a kid being soothed to sleep by algebra, right? So we need to take numbers out of economics in a way and put the storytelling back in so it opens up pathways in people's heads that aren't blocked. Not to say that we don't need precision and mathematics and kind of, we need all that stuff. But at the forefront, Evan, should be stories that make sense to us. Stories of good and evil, of stability, of instability, of war and peace, of value and non-value. And that's, I think, what really makes the world go round. Because if you understand that, and if we teach our kids to understand this, that we are giving them an essential building block to understand the technology that will, fortunately or unfortunately, dominate much of their lives. And that's why I think we should liberate them with history, stories, with anthropology, with understanding, with explanations, and with a bit of fun, Kevin.
Mm-hmm. Stories always help. Do you have time for just one quick one?
Dude, and then I'm going to fly.
What are the most important lessons from the history of money that policymakers today are ignoring?
Oh, now that's a very, very, very good one. I think the most obvious lesson is that money animates human flourishing. It makes us different, right? And the promise of money, Kevin, is that it was back in the old days and still now, that you can change your present situation with money. You can change your life. Your life can be made better, okay? And how does that happen? It means that what I've always thought is, like, with money, with a certain amount of money, humans see the world differently. I've always thought that one of the big differences between poor people and rich people, certainly in Ireland, is that rich people have very long time horizons. They plan for 10 years. If you meet a poor guy, they need the money today. So the reason the payday loans are actually afflicting poor guys is because they need the money today. So basically, poverty obliterates the future. It obliterates your time horizon. So, you know, middle-class dad like me can say to my son, look, you know, go to college. don't worry about things for a few years. I'll back you up. Let's come back in 4 years' time when you've got your degree and we'll think. So suddenly my son's time horizons are extended. Poor dad can't do that. Poor dad doesn't have the cash. That means poor kid doesn't have the cash. So the kid doesn't build what we call their own social capital, right? They don't create their own networks that are at stake. So once we understand that, then it's so clear to me that policymakers should be trying to get as much money, which is the alchemy, to as many people as possible. Now, how do we do that? You can do that in a variety of ways. But the main one is to create a banking system, which is the intermediary between the central bank and the people, that is much more representative of the average dude. In the old days, we used to have cooperative banks. We call them credit unions in Ireland. So these sort of things that once you understand that money. So for example, one of the most amazing things in Bangladesh and India is a thing called microbanking, where poor people get small amounts of money to do small things, right? And incrementally their lives improve dramatically on their own steam. And I think that's the way we should go, because there's no point having Wall Street looking after Wall Street. Wall Street's already rich. They've already got buckets of money, right? And as a general rule, if you take a billionaire is one dude with $1,000,000,000. It's much better for society to have a million people with $1,000. Okay? If you think about that, right? That's so obvious. Yeah. So this banking system has to provide what I would call a social role. Not that it's giving money away, no. But what we also know, Kevin, I'll leave you in this one, is that rates of default amongst poor people are much lower than rates of default amongst rich people. And that's an amazing thing. It's rich guys who walk away from big loans.
Mm-hmm.
Your average poor guy works his tail off to keep paying back stuff. So I would say that that would be a very interesting way if the Fed could recalibrate American finance to provide a role for cooperative banks to underpin and help poorer people, because at the end of the day, the way in which societies remain stable and people have good lives and their kids have good lives is if they have a stake in the society. And the more financial inclusion you have, the more opportunity you have, the smaller a little business is, or a kid wants to go to college, these are all progressively important things for having a stake. And you can do that through the financial system and still make money.
The book, The History of Money, A Story of Humanity. We were just joined by the author, David McWilliams, who took 5,000 years of financial history, made it engaging and accessible to all instead of technical and dry. David, thank you so much for your time and writing this book.
Cheers, Kevin. And we'll see you back in the Kennedy homestead in Ireland one of these days.
Sounds fantastic. You enjoy the rest of your day. Stay with us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.